Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
This is a big national story, and I wanted to localize it and do a deep dive on it this morning. The family of Vincent Jackson, who's a former NFL wide receiver who was found dead back in February at the age of 38, was in fact diagnosed with CTE after a brain study was conducted by researchers. And what's interesting is Vincent's diagnosis comes just days after it was revealed that NFL cornerback Philip Adams, who was accused of fatally shooting six people to death before taking his own life in April, also had stage 2 CTE. His diagnosis, very similar to Aaron Hernandez, a former NFL tight end for the Patriots, who was convicted of murder back in 2015 before taking his own life in 2017. And also Jovan Belcher, who is the former Kansas City Chiefs linebacker who killed his daughter's mother and then took his own life in 2012, also showing signs of CTE. So again, it seems like it's pretty rare when you look at the hundreds of thousands of NFL players who have gone on and off the field, but it is something that continues to come up in the news. And I wanted to do a deep dive on it this morning, starting with a conversation with Dr. Carl Nissen. Now, Dr. Nissen is an MD. He's an orthopedic surgery specialist in Hartford and has over 31 years of experience in the medical field. And Dr. Nissen, thank you so much for coming on this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. It's my pleasure.
First of all, I can never pronounce it correctly. What does CTE stand for?
I think everybody has trouble with it. It's chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Okay. And what exactly is that?
So the problem is we're not really 100% sure. So that's one of the big concerns. And that's why, as you just recited, there's, you know, multiple folks who have been diagnosed with this post-mortem, because that's really the only time you can make the diagnosis. But it is felt that chronic traumatic encephalopathy, or CTE, comes from repeated subconcussive blows over the course of somebody's life, whether it be an athlete on the field, whether it be military personnel involved in military maneuvers or in combat, or whether it be somebody else who just for some reason has repeated head blows, head contact.
Okay, so, and I just want to reiterate or clarify. So you cannot detect CTE at this point until you can't do it until you die, essentially.
That's correct. Yeah, so the only time that definitive diagnosis can be made is on autopsy. And that's actually one of the things that has really brought this to light, is since approximately 2012, 2015, many individuals have donated their brains to be studied once they passed on, just for fear that they had the symptoms of CTE and therefore were trying to help the system. But to find the tau protein and the atrophy of the brain, obviously it's just not something you can do until somebody passes on and you actually can touch and feel and study the brain specifically.
And I noticed there's different stages, almost like a cancer. What are the stages of CTE?
Yeah, well, they start at the initial stages. They're just people that have some mood changes, people that are very lack impulse control, perhaps. They have rapid swings in their emotions. They sometimes show over-aggressiveness, and sometimes just they're anxious. And as obviously as that list shows, it's really somewhat non-specific, non-distinct symptoms initially. And probably the best thing we can do is see that somebody who doesn't have those symptoms over the course of a few years starts to demonstrate all of those. And that's what first alerts us that somebody may, in fact, be suffering from CTE or from, you know, the early signs, as you say, the early stages of CTE.
And it seems like also, Dr. Nissen, that suicide seems to be coinciding with it as well, at least in the cases of these football players.
Yeah, I mean, so obviously suicide is the ultimate, you know, in human life. So when people do commit suicide and have CTE, it raises awareness for us all. However, just in the studies that have been done, we can't prove that suicide is, you know, CTE, or that CTE always results in suicide. But there is no question that there are many folks who have been diagnosed postmortem with CTE. they passed on because they committed suicide. So that's true. It's just not a direct one-to-one relationship. So we have to be a little bit careful about making the diagnosis of CTE because somebody was emotional, anxious, and committed suicide.
Sure. Well, and as you mentioned earlier in this interview, Dr. Nissen, we wouldn't even know if they had CTE if in fact they don't donate their brain for research, essentially. So it would be very unfair to say that suicide is a direct correlation. It just seems like that's something that's come out of, at least in these NFL player situations, all of the ones who have been diagnosed with at least stage two or higher CTE, so far in these reports have taken their own lives, which is terrible.
It is truly terrible, for sure.
And I'm curious, Dr. Nissen, where does the, I know you said aggressive in nature, is that sort of why, unfortunately, in the two incidents I had mentioned at the top of this interview, like Phillip Adams or an Aaron Hernandez or even Jovan Belcher, the aggressive nature, is that why potentially these players could have committed heinous acts of murder?
Yeah, it certainly could be, Melissa. So there's, you know, the link of mood swings and aggressive behavior actually fits. But on the other side of the coin, some of the best NFL football players, Australian rules football players, some of the best athletes, the reason they're great athletes, or part of the reason they're great athletes, is because they are aggressive by nature. They have the ability to behave, you know, in aggressive fashion. And, you know, just watching football yesterday, I mean, some of the best "quote unquote" plays were because people were aggressive against the other team and making a tackle or what have you. So it's really, I think it's more the change. So it's more of a change, maybe in personal life, as a, for instance. So when somebody's, you know, leading their life, if you will, in a normal fashion, they have a family perhaps, and then they start to show aggression towards their family members or their friends. So it's the change in behavior, the change in moods that go from not a docile person necessarily, but somebody who's, you know, able to control their aggression off the field, to somebody who can't, and maybe they lash out verbally or physically, for that matter, during their early stages.
Interesting. Dr. Carl Nissen is here, an orthopedic surgery specialist in Hartford with over 31 years of experience in the medical field. He actually graduated from UConn School of Medicine Medical School, and we are talking about CTE this morning. So I know you mentioned, Dr. Nissen, different signs of CTE, but I guess my question is, what can someone do? So say you have an athlete in your family and you notice these mood swings, or like you said, someone who was in the military, you notice things like the aggressive behavior, the mood swings, the depression, things that your spouse or your family member never had before. What can you do? I mean, like, can you, because you can't detect CTE until they pass away, what can you, you know, actively do to help them? Like, can you live with CTE, I guess, is my question?
Yeah, so great questions, and obviously very important in these folks that are affected with it. So the first and most important is to not push them aside. I mean, you know, people that start to exhibit these behaviors sometimes become, they go on their own and become isolationists and really don't want to interact with folks. And obviously that's the worst thing, because that would just add to all these symptoms. So you know, as a loving family, if you think somebody's coming down with any of these diseases, anxiety, depression, et cetera, but certainly if they have CTE, is to embrace them, is to hold them closer, because you can temper the symptoms of CTE. You can't solve it. So once the protein has started to get deposited in the brain and it is deposited along the sulci and into the actual fibers of the nerve fibers in the brain, you can't get rid of them. So you can't, just like arthritis, you can't stop it from progressing. You can slow it down probably, though, by supporting the individuals. Certainly if, you know, if in the future, as we start to look for markers and things to allow us to identify CTE at a younger time, then maybe true prevention will be possible. But really, right now, it's just supportive care.
But even with supportive care, Dr. Nissen, you're saying if you had stage two, for example, that will progress. It is going to get worse.
We know of no reason that it wouldn't. I guess it's the, you know, so it's a double negative, and I apologize for doing that. But it's not that it can't get better. It's just the likelihood of being able to turn a clock back is extremely small.
Okay, so even if you're not, you know, continuing with the military or sports where you have head trauma, it just naturally from research, it probably is going to progress, and nothing to apologize for, just to better understand it. I just want to make sure.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. I mean, obviously, if we are correct and that a CTE is caused by repetitive or multiple subconcussive blows to the head, obviously removing an individual from a situation where they might suffer or reduce the risk they might suffer another blow, that would be the best thing to do.
Okay. So it's only head hits. Like, you can't be born with CTE, correct?
That's correct. As far as we know, you cannot be born with it.
Okay. And it can't come from anywhere else. It has to be continuous hits. And that's what I thought was also interesting it seems like it's relatively rare, if I'm fair to say that, Dr. Nissen, and please correct me if I'm wrong. But, you know, when you hear about excessive hits to the head, for example, in our household, you know, my husband's asked the question, why don't I have CTE? And I said, well, because God is good. But, you know, my husband, who played football and rugby for years, I can't count how many concussions he's had. So it is interesting why it's developed in a small population of people. When that's a very common thing, especially for athletes who play like hockey or football, you know, why is CTE not that common, if that makes sense?
Yeah. So, again, going back to the fact we can't prove the etiology of this, we only know that the individuals that we are seeing and we are talking about now and the ones that you've mentioned earlier are the ones that have had repeated blows to the head. The one thing that has come out, and this is maybe gets a little bit on the periphery of the research involved with CTE, but something I'm sure that you've heard about or know about, is the encouragement by coaching staffs, the encouragement by family members, the encouragement by players themselves, once they've had a subconcussive blow, once they've had head trauma, to go back and continue to play before they're fully recovered, before they fully rehab, is in all likelihood, as the research comes out, it appears that that's a group of individuals that has increased risk of developing CTE.
Interesting.
So, you know, I think you've talked with and are going to talk with others about this, you know, things that we can do, especially in the high school players, to try to help and prevent CTE from developing. We want to recognize folks that have had a brain injury. We want to recognize, certainly if they've had a concussion or something more serious, we need to know about it just to save their life. But also if they've had a significant brain injury, if they've had mild traumatic brain injury, which is just another set of words to describe concussion, we want to make sure that they fully heal before they return back to play, before they get back into a situation when they might have another blow, because the brain is felt to be susceptible, just like any other part of our body for that matter. Mm-hmm. If we have an injury, it's not as strong or resilient at absorbing another blow, and therefore a successive blow would have an increased injury rate, an increased severity. And that's probably what we're close to being able to say that, you know, in a definitive fashion. I think most of the folks like myself as sports physicians, certainly this is what we tell everybody, is you're not allowed to return back to play or put yourself in a risky situation where the risk of another blow was high, because we think that that's likely not only going to cause short-term problems, but certainly could lead to long-term problems like CTE.
Dr. Nissen, we appreciate you taking the time to give us as much information as you can about CTE, and thank you for spending it here on WICC. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Glenn Lungarini is here this morning. He's the executive director of the CIAC, and good morning to you, Glenn. Thanks for popping back on the show.
Good morning, Melissa. It's a pleasure to be back on with you.
So we chatted with Dr. Carl Nissen just a few minutes ago and did a deep dive into what CTE is, how you can detect the signs and symptoms of it, how do you get it. So we have a basis and an understanding of what it is. And I think it's great timing to now have you on to talk about what we can do for young athletes. So our understanding is, if you are in the military or if you are an athlete, essentially, and you have multiple head blows is what Dr. Nissen called it. That's your best bet for getting CTE, not that we're striving for it. So I wanted to know, you know, especially football, hockey, rugby, those are some of the standout sports, at least in my mind, that I think of that would be susceptible to CTE. What are we doing to protect young athletes from this?
Sure. In Connecticut, we have been, I think, one of the leaders in the country. You can look back more than a decade ago when legislature enacted concussion legislation along with CIAC to help look at how we treat kids who have concussions, how we reduce the impacts of that. So, for example, within the sport of football, we've taken a close look at contact time. We continue to look at that on an annual basis. And in fact, 2 years ago, we reduced the amount of contact time, which was already fairly minimal, by 50%. So we're looking at ways that we can keep kids safe. We're looking at strategies within collision sports, as you mentioned, hockey, football, lacrosse. Believe it or not, one of the highest sports that has concussion rates is cheerleading. And, you know,
sure.
So we look at these sports and try to identify strategies, tackling methods, hitting methods, contact methods that take the head out of that process and make it safer for both the tackler and the person being tackled.
The other thing, too, Glenn, that Dr. Nissen had brought up was the idea that if you do get a concussion, how essential it is that you don't go back to play until a doctor gives you clearance. So until your concussion has fully healed, because he said that could increase your chances of getting CTE, is the people who get back out on the field before they're fully healed.
Absolutely. Knowledge and information about how to treat concussions as well as prevention, I think, is key in keeping our kids safe. So along with the looking at the amount of contact time that we have, there are prescribed protocols and procedures that you need to follow once you are diagnosed with a concussion to be able to return. And there are specific individuals that are identified who can do that. So your doctor can do that, your school nurse, your athletic trainer. It's very prescribed who the people are that can clear you to come back. So a coach in and of himself or herself would not be able to just clear a kid to come back and play after a blow to the head. It would have to be done by somebody who is identified as a medically qualified to do so.
On average, Glenn, of course, every case is different, but how long are you usually out for a concussion?
Well, as you said, each case is different, and it depends on the, you know, on the severity of that, but it's usually a minimum of a week.
Okay. Glenn Lungarini is here with the CIAC. Now, I'm curious, Glenn, I know you had said, you know, Connecticut is sort of a leader in this, in this fight to keep our kids safe when they're playing these high contact sports. And I think that's great. I'm curious, does CTE come up in either meetings with, not even meetings between the CIAC, because I'm sure that you guys are very informative to coaches and things like that. But do you have any idea if coaches and parents have these conversations before seasons start? So I know, like, kids will go home with permission slips or whatever. Hey, you can join the team or whatever, and the parents sign off on it. Do you know if there's anything in writing or any kind of sit-down meetings happening at the high school level to explain the severity of CTE specifically?
So CTE specifically, not necessarily. We do extensive work on head trauma and concussions. We do have our coaches every 5 years are required to take a 3-hour course on concussions on an annual basis. They're required to take a refresher of that course. Also, each sports season, when parents and kids sign up, they're provided with literature on concussions to help educate. When we have the discussions nationally and locally, we do try to continue to stay up to date with the studies and the information available on CTE. But I think, you know, one of the challenges with it is it's something, to my understanding, that really can't be assessed or diagnosed until a person is passed on. So the amount of information that I think we have specific to CTE is growing, but we do know how we can prevent and help take measures to reduce concussive head trauma. And so that's what we focus on, knowing that also will help hopefully reduce CTE.
And of course, Glenn Lungarini is the executive director of the CIAC. Glenn, I know you said that Connecticut has passed legislation specifically surrounding concussions and the safety of students. Do you feel like more can be done? Not saying that we're not doing a good job, but if you were to make a recommendation, do you feel like we are doing enough, or do you think there are some other things we could put on the table?
Well, as I mentioned, just 2 years ago, we reduced the amount of contact time in the sport of football by 50%. So I think that just, you know, demonstrates that we don't ever feel that we can sit back, we've done enough, and we don't have to look at, you know, head trauma. We don't need to look at concussive injury any further. We look at this consistently in all sports, particularly our collision sports. But this is something that each year that goes by, we have more data, more research. So, you know, it's something that it's critical that we stay up to date on and make changes as appropriate to try to keep our kids as safe as possible.
And as you mentioned before, Glenn, you know, every case, every student, every athlete is totally different. Every single person has a different story. But, you know, when you hear about these NFL players, these former NFL players who passed away most times from suicide and they end up getting diagnosed with CTE, a lot of times you hear that they had been in contact football since they were 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. So I'm wondering, you know, would you ever recommend that if you have a child who, for example, is a defensive tackle or a wide receiver and they've taken blows to the head since they were 12 up until they even get into their high school years multiple times, would you ever recommend that they maybe think twice about continuing this, especially if they don't plan to go professional? Like, would you ever recommend they don't go collegiate?
I think that would be a very personal decision that mm-hmm. would be made between families and certainly medical advisors, the doctors that are treating the individual. We have seen cases where, again, kids have received multiple injuries, multiple concussions, and then have been advised not to continue in collision sports or sports that have, you know, high potential impact for head trauma. And then, again, we've seen, you know, kids who have gone through the right protocol and have been cleared to come back and play and have very successful seasons. I think it's important for people to know, again, in Connecticut, we look at this regularly. We take it very seriously. I think football, lacrosse, hockey from the youth levels on up, at least in our state, are very safe. And I do know across the country, the National Federation of High Schools has really put an emphasis on this. They've partnered with USA Football and the NFL to look at developmental programs from your induction into the sport of football, moving up through the high school level to, again, really monitor and limit the potential concussive impacts through the developmental phases of the game.
And really quick, last question, Glenn, where did the big changes come? You said a couple years ago we changed legislation or we introduced it here in Connecticut. Did Aaron Hernandez's story have anything to do with that, only because he was born and raised in Connecticut and he played football in Connecticut before going to the Pats?
No, it was actually well before that. I want to say that the concussion legislation, again, I'm not don't have it written down in front of me, but I believe it was 2010.
Okay.
So I think we've been over a decade with that legislation. And then, as I said, we look at it on a regular basis. And about 2 years ago, we were comparing spring football, which we held in Connecticut, to what other states do. And then we were looking at how much time we were actually using to have full contact in practice. And with those, we determined in Connecticut that it would be appropriate to eliminate spring football and those potential exposures. And then we also determined that our coaches were only using about 50% of the time that was allotted them. So we actually reduced that time down to what we felt was appropriate and actually being used and practiced as the standard to, again, help keep kids safe. And that was really driven by coaches. And so, again, our coaches are on top of this as well.
Glenn Lungarini, we so appreciate you weighing in on this conversation and giving us this insight. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Have a great holiday, and thank you for having me on.
Thank you. You too, Glenn.
Let's head to Fairfield now, where First Elect Woman Brenda Kupchick is standing by. Good morning, Brenda. How are you?
I'm well, Melissa. How are you?
I'm good. Merry Christmas. Are you ready for this weekend?
Merry Christmas. Yes, yeah, so I'm running around like everyone else trying to get ready, right?
Oh, you're the chicken with her head cut off. Yeah, I'm me too. Me too. We're doing the best we can, but you know, it's exciting. It's exciting. It's busy,
yeah,
but it's exciting.
It's busy.
Well, earlier this month, the Yankee Institute came out with a new study. It was called Warning Signs 2021 Update. It said most of Connecticut's towns and cities face significant unfunded liabilities from pension and retiree health care benefits, which are promised to current and former employees. They said as a group, municipalities owe more money for benefits promised to current and former employees than they do for their own infrastructure. And I had kind of thrown this at Brenda because the morning Brenda came on, we had the Yankee Institute on, and I thought, oh, you know, Brenda's here. Why don't I find out how she feels about it? Now, of course, Brenda hadn't even seen the article until I literally said, hey, it came out this morning. So we wanted to follow up with that this morning. After reading through it, Brenda, what can you tell us?
So, you know, we looked at that, you know, I was glad you brought it up. And so we looked at it and, you know, I talked about it when I came into the office and we were looking at it, and it's supposed to be ranking the fiscal health, right, of Connecticut towns.
Correct, yeah.
And it refers to lower ranked towns being more stressed. But the reports, you know, has Fairfield, you know, 25th most stressed town in the state out of 169. And I was really shocked to see that because it's kind of misleading. So the best way to measure your town's fiscal health is to look at the bond rating. And Fairfield is a AAA rated town.
Mm-hmm.
And our pension fund is over 80% funded. And then our OPEB liability, which we make substantial contributions to. And our rainy day fund is greater than 10% of our entire budget. So we have a really strong rating as far as that goes. And we don't have a pension system anymore. And if you read the article, you know, they were pointing to towns who still have pensions, you know, that they're giving out to their current employees. And Fairfield did away with that a while ago. So we shut that down. And the report recommends that towns should do actuarial valuations more often than every 5 years. That's required by our state statute. But we do a pension valuation every year. And our new OPEB valuations every 2 years. So we have a pretty strong financial status. And then also the ability to pay. You know, the town, Fairfield's town, we're at a collection rate of 99.01%.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the highest rate in over 10 years. So I'm not really sure. Listen, I'm not saying we can't do better. All towns can't do better. And there's always room for improvement, but we've been taking, you know, some serious steps to keep our bonded debt under control and make consistent contributions to our long-term obligations. So I'm not sure that this report is an accurate reflection of Fairfield's financial situation.
Interesting. I'm curious, Brenda, not that the two are connected at all, but I wasn't sure if the reason, because that's why I asked the question, was you're right, you know, at the top of the list was Bridgeport and Stratford. They were at the very top of the list. So when I noticed that Fairfield was in the top 25, I was a little surprised and taken aback, but then I was wondering, not that they're connected, but I was curious, do you think the dumping scandal and the money that's being spent on that, do you think that has anything to do with the fiscal health of Fairfield?
You know, well, if you read the report, Melissa, it doesn't seem to mention it.
Right, it never mentioned it.
It's talking about fund balance contributions and OPEB and pension liabilities. And so Fairfield's, you know, we have a board of finance, and my finance department is, you know, they're pretty good. And we review these things on a consistent basis. And so I'm just not sure. I'm not sure. I think it's kind of misleading the way that they're calculating it.
Okay.
I don't think they looked at the whole picture. So, I feel very confident. Like I said, I think there's always room for improvement.
Sure, with everybody. Yeah.
I mean, when COVID first hit in the beginning, you know, we scrambled. I had put my budget out like a week before we had passed it through the Board of Selectmen before COVID hit. And then the budget had to go through the process of the Board of Finance. And I know I sat down with those guys and I was like, wow, we've got to make a zero. We've got to try to get to a zero. Because we were all terrified that, you know, the country was shutting down and residents wouldn't be able to handle any tax increase.
Mm-hmm, sure.
You know, people are losing their jobs. So what we did was we didn't fully fund the pension I mean, excuse me, not the pension, the fund balance, and didn't make the full contribution that we normally do to our OPEB. But then the following year, we paid that all back and then some. So that caused us to have a little bit of an increase the following year. But we took those steps, and that was like a huge deal. I mean, we were agonizing over doing that.
Right.
Fairfield takes contributing to these important funds really seriously. Mm-hmm. And you'll see some towns who don't do it. You know, because, hey, it costs a lot of money. It raises taxes.
Right.
But it's also important to make sure you're on sure footing. So I'd be curious to even talk to the Yankee Institute more to understand, you know, were they looking at everything? Because it seems like they may have left some things out.
Yeah, and I certainly would love to do a follow-up. That's why I'm glad to get your perspective on this, because I think these are really great follow-ups, and certainly would love to have them back on. I'll call their PR manager after the show. We're talking to Brenda Kupchick, the first electwoman of Fairfield. I have a couple more topics on hand, Brenda, that I want to chat with you about. First of all, let's actually jump to COVID, because I wanted to spend more time on youth crime, but I wanted to talk about COVID real quick. Sacred Heart and Yale, the two latest colleges in Connecticut to say that they're going to require boosters in the spring. I'm curious, or for the spring semester, I should say. I'm curious only because Sacred Heart does fall somewhat in Fairfield. Is Fairfield U going to require the booster soon?
I'm not aware if they're doing that yet.
Okay.
They haven't announced that to us. I mean, we stay in close contact with both universities. I mean, we're watching everything in this town every day. We monitor it.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I have to tell you, this surge that we're experiencing now, you know, I listen to you in the mornings now, Melissa.
Thanks, Brenda. I appreciate it.
I do. And so, I don't remember the doctor's name that
Dr. Brown
talked to.
Yep.
Dr. Brown. So I enjoy listening to you two talk. And, you know, he has mentioned, and I actually agree with him, that we're kind of going into this turning into an endemic.
Mm-hmm.
We're at a point almost 2 years in here that what are we doing? You know, my chief of staff, who is actually home this morning with her almost one-year-old, Vinny, working from home and then mm-hmm. coming in later,
wow.
Sent me this article from Time Magazine regarding, you know, how are we monitoring this? You know, we're still monitoring case rates, all of these things, the same exact way we were before there was even a vaccine.
Right, right.
We're looking at this the same way that, and it just doesn't seem right. And so now we have, you know, we have vaccine widening availability. We have boosters available for all adults. We have effective oral antiviral drugs that prevent hospitalizations and death. So we have all these different things that we didn't have. And in by acknowledging, you know, the CDC recently acknowledged that we can't get a herd immunity.
Right.
With this.
Right. No, this is going to be like a flu season. COVID's not going to go anywhere. COVID's here to stay.
Right. So,
right.
You know, asking about, you know, I've had less than a dozen people over the last 2 weeks ask if the town of Fairfield would mandate a mask mandate.
And bringing it back.
Frankly, I just think that's, I just don't think it's needed. I
mm-hmm.
think people are getting vaccinated, and I think we really need to push to educate and try to help people understand that that vaccination is really important, and that even the CDC should be more looking at COVID sort of the way they do the flu seasons, right? They monitor
it,
and then if they see an uptick, they supply specific drugs to help lessen the severity of it to areas where they see high spikes,
mm-hmm.
and getting just back to normal life. I mean, will we be like this for the next 10 years, or are we going to just push, you know, encourage people to get vaccinated? Because there's still a lot of people unvaccinated.
And we are back this morning chatting with Brenda Kupchick. She's the first select woman of Fairfield. And we wanted to continue talking about COVID, but also youth crime this morning. Brenda, just kind of to wrap with COVID, so it doesn't sound like you guys are going to be bringing back a mask mandate, which it doesn't seem like a lot of towns and cities are doing that anyway. So it seems like you're kind of par for the course. Where are you guys with COVID cases? I mean, most of Connecticut is back in the red, it seems like.
Right. So, I'm glad you bring that up. Right. So we have been judging the way they judge case rates. So red now is, to me, a little bit misleading at this point, right? So 15 cases per 100,000 residents. That shouldn't mean red anymore. These are cases. It doesn't mean you're in the hospital. It doesn't mean you're dying. It means you have it.
Right.
And basically what's happening, and you talk about this every day, it's a cold. People are sick a little. If they're vaccinated, they're getting very mild symptoms. So I just think that there needs to be a reset button. And even the governor, when I hear him speaking to you, he's not talking about a mask mandate for the state of Connecticut.
No, he doesn't want it. He doesn't want it. Nope.
So, right. So, I mean, I just feel like I think the CDC and the State Department of Public Health need to push a reset button here and look at this and define it differently now. It shouldn't be defined the same way it was before we had vaccinations and access to drugs to help people stay out of the hospital. I just think we need to look at it differently. That's all.
Yeah. No, I think a lot of people also want to look at it differently, especially when you hear, like you mentioned, Dr. Brown, who says this is basically going to be another flu. We're essentially going to be talking about COVID for the rest of our lives. So, you know, even when you hear Dr. Fauci, who's like, look, are you ever going to get on a plane without a mask again? No, probably not. But who cares? I mean, to me, I'm like, who cares? I it's almost gross that we did get on planes without them, quite frankly. So I don't know. In some ways, you're right. It's like, you know, when do you turn a corner and make the pandemic just, unfortunately, something that's just going to be part of life. I mean, it seems like it's here to stay.
Yeah, but you see these reports sometimes on the news, and you see a family being kicked off an airplane because their one-year-old is crying and doesn't want to keep the mask on.
So, those stories are insane. And to me, I understood that far too well. I had a 2.5-year-old who wouldn't wear a mask when we went down to Disney. I totally get that, and I think. I do find the airlines overall, I mean, I haven't experienced all of them, but some of them are very like understanding. We get it. We get it. But I agree. I mean, I think I think if you were to keep mandates like mask mandates, I would up the age to until vaccines are available. I would up the age to like 3 or 4. I do think that 2 is way too young, I think. But
right. So I just think that we need to all take a deep breath. And I mean, look at our country has come so far. It's incredible how far we've come fighting against this horrible thing. And I think we need to now reset the button and look at it as it is.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Brenda Kupchick this morning. Brenda, you were the first person to respond to me immediately. You're so good. I think I had texted you on like a Thursday night, and I couldn't believe you responded right away about the social media TikTok challenge thing that had basically a lot of Connecticut, most of the nation up in arms and worried about schools. I'm just curious what your thoughts kind of are with youth crime right now, not just with social media and school threats, although we're seeing that happening right now, but also like even just like the car thefts, you know, kids hijacking cars with babies still inside and so on and so forth.
Yeah, it's incredible, right? And so this has been a hot topic in our town. Mm-hmm. And we've had several forums in town with local law enforcement, members of the Justice Department, legislators. And I feel like there's just been a disconnect between what's actually happening and how the data is being reviewed. So, you know, some legislators are pointing to data saying, well, COVID has caused the increase in crime. And frankly, our law enforcement are saying, hey, listen, this has been upticking for a while now. And when we have, you know, a 16-year-old or an underage minor in a car in front of an ice cream store when the parents are in the shop get carjacked, or two teachers have a weapon pointed at them in front of the school in Southport when they're trying to go to work. And just now, I mean, today, this morning, I got a report from our chief last night and it's been now reported in the news today, that, you know, two teens were, caught in a stolen car, and they were 13 and 16 years old, and they were involved in a carjacking earlier. There's a disconnect, right? And I've heard the governor talk to you about this, and he has said there's got to be consequences.
I just don't know what those are. Like, nothing's been told.
Right. So, yeah. So according to our law enforcement, they say to me that in the juvenile courts, that they cannot impose anything greater than either a 16 or 18 month probation on anybody.
So what does that do?
If a 14-year-old carjacks somebody, if he points a gun at somebody, and in the instance of that young man who got shot by a juvenile in Bridgeport and is now crippled because of it, at some point in time, somebody has to move to adult court. And I know some people in the legislature feel like that's too heavy of a hand, but I don't think it is, because there's got to be some consequences here. And so when the governor says there has to be consequences for juveniles, I want to know exactly what he's talking about, because what is the consequence? Is it juvenile, detention like we used to have in the state of Connecticut,
right,
where there would be a consequence, some assistance at that center, not like throwing someone in adult jail, but putting a young person who is out of control and committing really dangerous crimes in a place where they get some treatment, they get some training, they get counseling, they get something to get them off this path of crime and protect the towns in the state of Connecticut. I just think this needs to be a really serious discussion, because, I mean, I can't believe what's happening in our town.
Yeah.
Stuff didn't happen. When there's an infant carjacked, I mean, what is going on?
I agree with you, Brenda. I agree with you. I know over the weekend we went to the Milford, Connecticut Post Mall, and we were literally walking in with our 3-year-old, and one aisle of cars over from us, there was a carjacking, and you could see somebody who was laying on the ground because they were obviously pushed to the ground. And I just thought, did we really just wait? And it was in the middle of the day. It was in the middle of the day. And I don't laugh because it's funny. I laugh because it's unbelievable. It just seems like we can't just keep relying on the fact that, oh, we don't live in a Chicago, so there's no problem. No, there's a problem, and it's getting worse. And I don't find that we keep saying we have consequences when I don't see it. I don't see the consequences. I don't see the fear.
Exactly. And I, you bring this up a lot during your show, and I really think you need to sort of push the governor a little bit more. And I don't mean that in a negative way. And I like the governor. I think you should just say to him, what do you mean by that?
Right.
When you say there should be consequences, what steps or what laws are in place to provide those consequences?
Yeah, exactly.
Because if you can only give probation in juvenile court to somebody, no matter what they did, regardless of how serious the crime is, then what is the consequence?
Right. Is there even a consequence? Brenda, I think you bring up a lot of great points and touch on so many great topics. Thank you so much for coming on and giving us extra time. I appreciate it.
Always. Have a great Christmas.
Thank you. You too, Brenda. Enjoy
Have
your family. Fun. Thank you. Thank you. We'll talk in the new year. Wow.
Absolutely.
Unbelievable. In the new year. Wow. See you in 2022.